Well, last session, I wanted to draw attention to the fact that there are dangers about being passionate about growing the church, particularly dangers associated with a desire to grow the church numerically. There are great dangers. But the big point I wanted to make was, and wanted to convince you of, and I trust I have, is that you can't be a Bible person and not have that passion. You cannot come close to the heart of God and not have a passion to see numbers of people converted, to see the church grow numerically. After all, he is the one who came to seek and save the lost. It is true, judgment and salvation bring glory to God, but he delights in salvation. And so I want to keep urging you down that path. Now, the outcome of these things, having a vivid awareness of the dangers of growth, having a passion for growth, and a vivid awareness of the need to be passionate about growth, the outcome of that is an unavoidable tension. You end up living with tension. Now, it is typical amongst church leaders who are deeply concerned to be true to Christ that they tend to one side of that tension. And which side do you think that might be? There's a tendency amongst Reformed evangelicals particularly to tend towards one side of that tension. And it happens like this, I think, in amongst Reformed evangelicals. We see the problems of the churches that are consumed with growing, consumed with getting more people to church. We see that problem and we retreat to what we think is the safety of being Bible men, careful theologians. And we imagine, I think, that that solves the tension. But it doesn't. Because if keeping close to the Bible then doesn't create in you a passion to see more numbers converted, then you've not retreated to the Bible at all. You've retreated to a particular view of the Bible, a particular part of the Bible, but not the Scriptures as a whole. Being close to the Bible should drive you out again to be passionate with all the dangers that compromise brings. Aware of all of those dangers. But the closer you are to the heart of God, the more it should drive you back to being passionate and then having to face all of those problems that come with being passionate for growth. The point I want to make is that there's nowhere safe. There's no place that you can plant yourself and go, at least I'll be safe. No, it's just, you cannot come to that point properly. The tension actually ought to drive us to our knees in prayer. That's where we ought to end up, is bringing all of this to our God, aware that the truest evidence of being close to the God of the Bible is prayers about growth, that we might see numbers converted, and prayers about the truth of the gospel, that we might guard the gospel for our time and the time to come, the next generation. But that tension ought to drive you to do more than just pray. It ought to drive you to take a look at the mirror. You need to have a look in the mirror and see yourself and what we are doing. Do you remember the quote from earlier? The Carl George quote. His assessment is that we are the single most significant reason for the failure of the church to reach our communities. Now, you hear all of this and it should begin to create pain. And we start to feel pressure. Not only do you have the pressure of a tough job, but this is some research that was done by, a friend in Sydney who went through the various ministers working in the Anglican denomination in Sydney, and his indications are very concerning. So what you have are ministers who are pretty much close to redlining in terms of workload. I understand people tell me that 55 hours a week tends to be the top efficiency number you can be working at ongoingly. Now, I'm not sure if that's the case for everybody. I think people can go past that in some cases. But by and large, you've got ministers all working near capacity time-wise with a massive amount of things that are putting demands on their week, what they have to spend time doing and not doing and so on. And all of that then creates the next thing, which is, let's see if we can do this, borderline burnout, 56%, burnout 20%, extreme burnout. It's only not an issue for 21. Thank you. Good on you. I actually need my glasses, but I can't find them. But But you've got significant burnout problems amongst the ministers, and here's the various things that are causing that down through the line. And so I don't doubt that you're in a similar place. You've got a lot on your plate. There's a lot of problems you're dealing with, a lot of issues that you're having to wrestle through. And then some bloke comes from the east coast of Australia in obviously the easiest place to do ministry, right? The central coast of New South Wales. And he comes and starts putting it on you as if you've got the problem. And I get the feeling. I feel that way when Americans come over, except from Oklahoma, or we're a beautiful place. But all of this pushes to the surface the classic get-out-of-jail-free card. What's the classic get-out-of-jail-free card? I'll tell you what it is. You're trying to pin the problem on me. But the fact is, the Bible says, what does it say? 1 Corinthians chapter 3? God gives the growth. Yeah? And so if there's a lack of growth, it's His thing, not mine. Yeah? My task is to be faithful with what I have, to preach the word, to pray, to love people. And whatever happens in my ministries, that's God's responsibility. Have you ever heard this before? Have you ever felt this before? You can't make me carry the burden of being responsible for growth. Now, this issue is so important, I'm going to spend a chunk of time on it now. And I'm going to dig deep with some issues here. I want to talk to you about organisational life. Organisational life. All organisations have two things. They have inputs and outputs. All organisations have them. The church is an organisation of a kind. It's an organic organisation. It's a body, but it's a building. It's a field. It's an organisation of some kind. And it has these two things, inputs and outputs. What's an input? Let's see if we can... Here we go. The inputs, the things we put into an organisation or a work, the things we put in. I mean, it's a fairly straightforward language, okay? So prayer, sermon, preaching, running growth groups, visiting people, there's just a quick snapshot of the things we put in, the inputs. But then you've got the outputs, the things that come out from all of the inputs, the outcomes, the effects, the difference that the inputs make. Now, the question for us, of course, is what is the output we're after in our ministries? What's the output we're after? Disciples. So the way I think of it is, the output is to make more disciples in ever-increasing number. There's the outcome I'm after. Now, disciple, what's the outcome that a disciple describes? A disciple describes two things, isn't it? It's someone becoming a disciple, conversion, and someone deepening in their life as a disciple, as a convert, being matured. So you might describe it as two outcomes. We want to see conversion and maturity. Disciples made. Now, are we seeing outputs from all our inputs? Are we seeing disciples made from all our efforts? Most of us are working very hard. Many of you like those slides. You'll be working your 55-hour week. You'll be going pretty hard. It's busy. It's impacting your life. Are you seeing any outcomes? How long since you've seen a convert? How many converts are you seeing per numbers of your congregation? Are lives being changed, transformed, revolutionized? Are you seeing outcomes? Now, this immediately throws up the next issue. What's the relationship between inputs and outputs? What's the relationship between the bits I put in and the outcomes that come out? Which is another way of asking the question, what's our part in all of this? Now, there are a few ways to conceive the answer, and I want to give it to you now. Let's see if we can pull this off. There's two ways of conceiving it. Inputs and outputs and their relationship. On the one side, it's possible to conceive the relationship between input and output as having, as being controlled. We'll go this one first. So that our efforts, our inputs, directly control the outcomes. What you put in, if you do it properly and everything right, then there will be a certain set of outcomes that are achieved. Let's see if this works. So there's a control, simple one-to-one relationship between input and output. If I pray this way, if I preach this way, if I organise the ministries this way, if I do all these various things, then we will see these outcomes achieved. And that's, of course, the problem with someone like me coming. The message can sound like, here's what happened at EV, we were there and now we're here, and here's the things I did, and if you just do it this way, then you'll see it all happen here in your context as well. And if you're not seeing it happen here in your context, it's because you're not doing it the way we did it. If I could just come over and do it for you, it would all be like we had it done. And that's what it can sound like. Now, you get this kind of thinking in revivalist theologies. So revivalist theologies, it's come in different guises over the years. In the period of time I've been in ministry, I've discerned three. It's not hard to pick these things up. One of them was transformations videos. Has anyone been around long enough to hear the transformations videos? So there's a whole bunch of stuff that happened in South America and West Coast of America, where whole societies were transformed. Even the fruit and veggies grew better, and all kinds of the crime rates dropped. Everything changed, and what was spruiked was the things that brought it about were half a dozen things that they did. One of the chief ones was that all the various ministers of the area put aside their theological differences and united together in the work. They called it the PGP or something like this, and they had prayer times together, not worrying about all their differences. And that unity, and the Bible says where there's unity, God commands a blessing, and so blessing came upon all of that. That came through the Central Coast where I was, and we were urged to put aside our differences between me and the Baptist, we put aside our differences, me and the Presbyterians, me and the Anglicans, I'm starting to feel a stretch, and then me and the Catholics, and I'm going, what? You mean there's works theology and grace theology is not an issue anymore, and if we just united, yes, that was the thinking, revivalist theology. If you do these five things, then you will see outcomes such as happened in various places in the world. Now, it came in another guise. There's been some material written on movements through history, and if you can identify through revivals through the history of the church, you'll see that there's a number of aspects that are common to each one, and therefore if you can just replicate those number of aspects, you'll see the same response occur. Now, the problem with all of this is historically it's a problem and theologically it's a problem. Historically, it's a problem. You go back to the transformation stuff and actually dig into what actually occurred in various of those towns, and it just didn't happen the way they said it happened. You go back through history and you look at the revivals that have occurred, and the fact is that, yes, many revivals you see discernible prayer beginning, which then led to, but other revivals you see, it actually brought about the prayer. So it's hard to actually identify that there is a set pattern that God always uses. Now, why do you think he doesn't use a set pattern? He wants to remind us who's in charge. He's sovereign. And theologically, 1 Corinthians chapter 3 says, God gives the growth. And so this concept of if you just do these five things and if you can just discern the particular pattern, you'll get the same outcomes is theologically, biblically, historically simply wrong. And it's a great blot on the Christian world. So it isn't appropriate to run with that poll. Now, what we therefore do is, we rightly respond, the Bible doesn't allow that to be the case, he is sovereign, but we tend, a group like us, if I've read us rightly, and I don't know all of you, of course, but a group like, we don't tend to fall for that one. So we recognise that that's wrong, and so what we do is we rush to the other side, which is to say there's no connection between our efforts and the results. We conclude that our task is just to be faithful, and whatever happens, happens by God's pleasure. Some ministries he blesses, some ministries he withholds blessing. We don't know why, we can't know why, and our job is to continue to be faithful, and God gives the growth as he gives it. Now, there are powerful conclusions from that flow. It protects the sovereignty of God. God does rule, we don't. It keeps us labouring when there isn't much fruit. So we press on no matter what occurs. And it protects our sense of worth. It's horrible to feel like what I'm doing might actually be the reason things aren't growing. I don't want to have that feeling. And what about the man who's working amongst the Muslims for 50 years? We don't want to make him feel bad. And so we want to affirm, just be faithful, the soil's hard. And so we're ploughing concrete, you don't expect much growth. And so you continue to trust God in the midst of it. And so it strengthens the hand of many in difficult places. And it releases us from the crushing burden of feeling that we are responsible for outcomes. Outcomes that seem out of our control. Living with that burden is dreadful, and we're released from it. And the only problem? This position isn't biblical either. Oh, it has some pieces that are right, some deeply important pieces. And I once would have said, I would rather fall into this ditch than the other. I'm not so sure anymore. But it does protect wonderfully the truth of God's sovereignty, which the Bible is very clear about. We are dependent upon Him at all times. He chooses to bless as He blesses, absolutely. We can't manipulate God. God's not like a slot machine. We can't just push the button and get the results. That He's not like a genie in a bottle that if you rub it three ways, He pops out and does your bidding. None of this is the case, of course. The only problem, though, is it's missed a whole theme that's throughout the Scriptures and is hurting our ministries badly. Have a look with me at Acts chapter 14. Acts chapter 14, verse 1. At Iconium, Paul and Barnabas went as usual into the Jewish synagogue. There they spoke so effectively that a great number of Jews and Greeks believed. Isn't that an interesting verse? In the Greek, it's an infinitive, so to speak. They spoke so effectively that a great number of Jews and Greeks believed. Do you see what Luke has done? He has tied the outcome to the input. It's the way they preached that's linked to the outcome that occurred. Yeah, you pick up other verse, James chapter 4, you do not have because you do not ask. You don't have outcome because you don't ask. Input. Now, I know, look, I can hear what's going on in your heads, and I can hear it loudly for many of you. Just because you pray doesn't guarantee you get what you ask for. Yes? Sure. And more. Actually, let me add to that. Sometimes you get what you need without even praying for it. Kathy, we had this great experience. So 20 years ago we planned. Within the first 2 years, 2 or 3 years in, our hot water service broke down. We've got 3 small kids that need baths and showers and all the rest. Happened on a Saturday. Day before Sunday, usually that happens in a week, isn't it? And so I'm madly trying to prepare a sermon for a church that's stressing me to the max. We're going 100 miles an hour. We're getting paid very little because we're in that early stage of a plant where there's no money. And we can't afford a new hot water service. And so Kathy comes and says, the hot water service is broken. What are we going to do? And I say, well, boil up water and just pour it over the kids. They'll be all right. But, which wasn't a very attractive thought at that stage. But here's the thing. Saturday night, she's going off with family who live in Sydney. She's going to visit them in Sydney, go to a restaurant in Mossman. Some of you will know Mossman. Mossman's a kind of a high income area. And she goes with the... I wasn't going because I was preparing the sermons and so on. But she's visiting there. They decide on a whim to, instead of drive to the restaurant, they walk. So they walk through the streets of Mossman up to the restaurant. They have a meal. At the end of the night, on a whim, they decide to walk back a different way. And so they walk back a different way. And as they're walking back a different way, in the distance they see all the rubbish from a particular house put on the side of the road ready for pickup coming week. Do you have that kind of thing here? And as they get closer, on the rubbish pile is a hot water system. Now it's Mossman. Why do you think somebody in Mossman is chucking a hot water service out? So my very clever wife goes and knocks on the door and says, why is there any reason particularly you're throwing out the hot water service? And the person says, it just doesn't fit the decor anymore. Works perfectly well. We just didn't like the colour. So she says, do you mind if we have it? And she says, no, of course not. So after church the next morning, I drive a trailer down, put it on the car, bring it back, get it installed, and it works for the next 5 or 6 years. Now, we didn't pray for that. Isn't that extraordinary? Now, what do you think happened after 5 or 6 years when that hot water service broke down? I just drive around all the streets looking for, you know, didn't get one. But you get the point? Yeah, okay, of course. I can pray and not always get what I pray for. I cannot pray and get what I just need exactly when I need it. But James says if you don't have, it's because you haven't asked. What you have is a far more complex sense of what's going on. You know, these verses, Acts 14 and James 4 and Romans 10, how can they hear unless someone goes and someone's sent? The salvation of people's tied to the input of us sending. And if we don't send, they don't get converted. 1 Corinthians chapter 3, interesting passage with the very point at which Paul says God gives the growth. He then expresses the fact that your ministry will be judged on its outcomes. You go and have a look at that later. It's what you've done, where your work will survive or not. Not whether you're faithful or not, though that is a piece. You know, the point here is that the Bible won't let you operate with one or the other. Because what the Bible presents is a far more complex thing where the inputs actually do have an impact on the outcomes. It's called compatibilism. If you've read Carson on this and so on in his book, How Long, O Lord, he has a discussion about this too. It's properly biblical theology worked out. So that, yes, we don't control the outcomes by our inputs. You don't just do this and this always happens. God is sovereign. But neither, therefore, is there no connection between input and output. Do you see? That ends up with a hyper-Calvinism. And I think many of us end up as intermittent hyper-Calvinists in our ministries. The Bible is a far more complex interplay between inputs and outputs. We don't control them, but there isn't no control. What I'm going to use is the language of influence. Our inputs influence the outcomes. This is written all the way through the Scriptures. A couple of illustrations. Farming. And Paul uses this, doesn't he? But the farmer does not control the outcome of the crop. Granted. But you can tell the difference between a hard-working farmer and a lazy farmer by the outcomes. You can tell the difference between a clever, smart, wise farmer by the outcomes. And isn't that the point of Paul in 2 Timothy 2 where he actually talks about the hard-working farmer is the one to receive from the... Because they think about this, he's saying. There's a wisdom you gain from the world about the way things happen. I'll give you the other one, parenting. Parents, you do not control the spiritual life of your children. You don't control whether they become regenerate, born-again believers. Yes. But neither do you have no impact on that. Train a child in the way they should go. And they won't depart from it. Proverbs 22, isn't it? Now, that's not saying it's a rule. It's not do it this certain way and you'll always get that. It's a proverb, but it's a proverb trading on the proverbial nature of relationship between cause and effect that occurs in our universe under God. And you can tell the difference between parenting and outcomes. Most of you have been around long enough to have seen the families who get consumed with sport only to find their kids don't come to church much anymore. I mean, I don't control the outcome, but I certainly influence it. Yeah? You know, if this is so, then something critically important flows. you cannot avoid bearing some of the responsibility for the state of our churches. Yes, God works as he works. He chooses to bless and sometimes withholds. But for many contexts and situations, the reason there is little impact is because of us. We have failed spiritually, perhaps. We fail to have the heart for the lost and the drive and passion for the lost. We've become complacent and dulled. We're not prayerful like we ought. We don't engage pastorally with the conversations that push people like we ought. We're not courageous enough in the pulpit. We don't say what needs to be said. We're too concerned to keep friends and friendships. We're not saying changing things that need to be changed because we're concerned about what it will mean for. There is a failure in our ministry expertise, wisdom, and strategizing. There's a failure in our managing of resources, a failure in delegations, a failure in pastoral sensitivities. But if you operate with the theology that says, I'm just to be faithful, and what happens is God, I'll never look. Because it's not really about me. I'm just teaching the Bible. I'm just praying and loving people. But there's a whole bunch of stuff we're doing that makes a huge difference. Now, this needn't crush us, though I kind of want it to for a while. It needn't crush us. Now, why? Well, because of the gospel. The gospel that's a gospel of grace. The gospel gives us the ability to look at ourselves without despairing, because I'm loved with an eternal love by a Father who has embraced me by virtue of the merits of another. So I can look at the mirror and go, I'm not what I'm meant to be. I'm not all that I should be. I'm failing in areas that I should be better at. And I can look at myself and go, I can honestly deal with that without being crushed, because God loves me. He sent his son to die for me. And I can keep pressing on to grow and be strengthened and enabled and keep doing, though I know I'm... Do you know this? So flee not to the sovereignty of God immediately. Flee to the grace of God in the gospel, first and foremost. Now, the sovereignty of God is a great comfort too. I think in the Islamic context, it's a massively important comfort. And many countries... I'm pushing us to actually look at ourselves as part of the whole problem. Now, I find all of this heavy. It brings a burden. But what I've discovered is, and it's not a big discovery, Paul lived with the same burden. Have you noticed in 1 Corinthians 11 and... 2 Corinthians 11. Come and look at 2 Corinthians 11. Let's quick bit of the Bible. Second Corinthians chapter 11, Paul talks about his weaknesses, and I don't know if you picked this one up, perhaps you have as well, but he lists all the pain and suffering he's gone through. Verse 27, I've laboured and toiled, often gone without sleep, I've known hunger and thirst, often gone without food, I've been cold and naked. Besides everything else, I face daily the pressure of my concern for all the churches. Now, what's interesting there is the word translated concern, it's been a long time since I've looked at it, so someone confirm this for me, is the word anxiety that's used in Philippians chapter 4. Do not be anxious, Philippians chapter 4, verse 6 and 7. Don't be anxious about anything, but in everything by prayer and petition. It's the same word here. Paul, who says don't be anxious, actually one of his weaknesses is that he feels the anxiety of the churches. Now, why would Paul feel, doesn't he sleep the sleep of the happy Calvinist? What is wrong with this guy? Do you know, he wrote Romans 9, 1 Corinthians 3. Well, he's not a hyper-Calvinist. Do you see? He's a compatibilist. He read Don's book. And he thought it all through back then. So he deals with the reality of what he brings, and he lives with this, what we do and how we do it. Now, do you understand why I'm pushing like this? Because if I'm right, if what we do and how we do it is making a difference, then until we own that and take seriously the need to deal with that, we won't see anything change. We won't reach escape velocity. We'll just keep going around and doing it around. But if you actually start to see, oh, well, I actually make a difference, it's not going as good because of the way I'm doing it, then you've got the potential to break out of that and start looking at your ministries and do them differently. You know, please forgive me if this sounds like it's a story about me, but Easter this last year, my father, Kathy's father's a wonderful, godly Christian man who was in ministry for many years. He was a church planter and so on and so forth. And he came over to lunch, I think it was, after Good Friday. And I'm standing at the barbecue doing something or other, pretending I know what I'm doing. And he's standing there chatting. And he said, "Wasn't it fantastic this morning?" And I said, "Yeah, it was great." And he said, "I had to take photos because our building was full." Our building's a large building, and it was packed with people, and I could see people with their phones out, kind of snapping photos and so on. And he said, "It was just so exciting to see so many people there." And he said, "The testimony." We had a bunch of testimonies on that day as well, that, you know, people had come to Christ and lives changed and so on. He said, "It's always so moving and wonderful to hear the testimonies." And then he said to me, "It's tricky, isn't it? The sovereignty of God." Said, if we could just take what's happening here and put it in another place, we would see more converts there. But God's sovereign. He said, "I don't know how to make sense of that." I said, "You need to come to a conference I'm speaking at." But it is that challenge. There are things that we can do that will make a difference. Feel that burden. What we do, how we do it, makes a difference in a range of areas. From the heart we bring, from the clarity of purpose that we have or don't have, for the vision we have for the work, for the skills we exercise and the way we do our work, they all make a difference. I've learned to live with contented discontent. Now, people talk about a holy discontent. I talk about contented discontent. Discontent with the way things are, with the way I am. Goodness me, I go to meetings and I don't even know what they're there for. I mean, I'm discontent about the way I am and the way I should be, and I feel the frustrations, and I'm discontent about the ministry. And I look at our ministries and I know that if we could just fix those six things, we'd see it move forward, but it's going to be painful and costly to fix them. And I live with the discontent of that. You know, I could list 20 things with each of you that if you could just change, your ministries would be more fruitful. If I sat with you and went through church with you, I could find them. So don't sit with me. You become discontent. It produces pain. Find the grace of God as your comfort. But then you need to lean into contentment. That the life of discontent is actually normal Christian life. And don't be depressed about being discontent. Be content in your discontent, do you see? It's evidence that those five things have taken root, your discontentedness, with the imperative. Learn to be content in that. And it's an awareness that you are a broken, sinful pastor. Is that news? And it's an insight that the church that you pastor is, yes, the bride of Christ, pure and spotless, but full of sinful fallen people this side of glory. So you love them. I'm content with this glorious thing and discontent with where we are. Now let me finish with one of the big pieces I want to add in, and then I hope we've got time for questions, so we'll see how we go. But I don't know where Tony is, but I've got just a couple more minutes. Let me finish with one big piece I want to add in before tomorrow, trying to give us a few more. One of the things I think that's a big problem that's hurting our work is a failure to focus on outputs. One of the big problems we have is an obsession with input thinking. What do I mean? Leadership that's focused on inputs is a leader that's focused on just doing what he does, whether or not it actually makes a difference. These kind of leaders think in terms of, I think I've got a slide there. These kind of leaders focus on inputs that keep doing church without considering whether it's making a difference or not. They don't look at the outcome of their work. They keep just thinking about what they should be doing and keep doing it. And if they sense any responsibility for the outcomes, it's only related to the inputs. So an input-focused leader is someone who, if they have any sense of responsibility, it's a sense of responsibility to make sure I keep preparing my sermon and preach it. I keep running that meeting and doing it. Do you see, my focus is on the responsibility to achieve the inputs. A leadership that's focused on outputs is a leader that's focused on the outcomes of all the inputs. It's a leader who's always seeing if their work is making a difference and what that difference is. So they care about inputs, the preaching and the praying, the pastoring, caring, but they also care about whether their preaching is connecting and getting through, whether people are actually growing under it, whether people are actually changing by it. And they care less about whether it ticks the college boxes of what the form of a sermon ought to look like. And they care more about whether it's actually changing lives. Do you see? Now, hopefully and rightfully, you'd expect that the way a good sermon should be shaped will make a difference. But what I find regularly is that people come and judge the message and they decide whether it's good or bad on whether it had the introduction, the 3 points and the conclusion, and they illustrated, stated, explained it, illustrated, applied in a proper order. What they're not interested in particularly is whether people are becoming converted and missionaries. There's lots of preachers in our land who break all the rules that you wouldn't have in a conference on preaching, but around them, magic is happening. You know, God speak, godly change is occurring, do you know? Now, friends, this is massively important. The input thinker just concerns themselves with making sure there's a Bible study group for people to come to. The outcome thinker is worried about whether the Bible study is actually achieving the outcomes we set it up to have, to achieve. And if it's not, why not? What have I got to do to fix it, to actually cause it to achieve the... when you think of all the decisions that you've got to make each day, the input thinker is just thinking about my day and what things I need to do as a faithful minister. The outcome thinker is thinking, what do I need to achieve with my day, with my life and ministry? So what will I do and not do to actually ensure that happens? See the difference? It's quite profound. Making a difference and focusing on outcomes makes a difference in almost every field of endeavour. You're flying to England. You get to choose the pilot. They're lined up at the terminal. You get to choose which bloke or man or woman you want to have doing the job. And you, okay, tell us about it. So he says, look, there's checklists. I'm going to go through all the checklists. I'll make sure I tick every box. I do my hours. But of course, I want to be a balanced, healthy life too. So I've got family and I've got other things I need to be responsible for. And I can't control what happens. Second pilot, what about you? And he says, I will do everything humanly possible to get the plane there. I'll tick all the boxes, I'll check all the lists, I'm awake at night worrying whether I've missed something. I'll go around the thing a couple of times extra just to make sure. Who do you want to have flying the plane? Yeah? Do you see the difference? I got a doctor who's an input thinker doctor. And I go to him and he says, look, you might have some serious thing, but Andrew, you're going to heaven and it's all okay. Now, what? Like, he's a lovely, godly Christian man who just, you're going to die anyway, and you're going to go, do you want that kind of doctor? No, I want the doctor who says, this is your only life, and I'm going to make sure I keep you alive as much as I can. Do you see the difference? Now, he's a good doctor too, but It makes a profound difference. Have a look at Colossians 1:28, a very familiar passage, but you look at this from these eyes and see what it says. Have a look at verse 28 again. What is that? Input or output? I think I heard someone say it. It's both. It's both. He's the one we proclaim, admonishing and teaching everyone with all wisdom. So there's the input. He's focused on what he needs to do, which is preach the word of God. Because the word of God is the power for salvation. Yeah? So he's focused on that input. He's focused on that input. Learning the secret of contentment too. He's focused on that input. But verse 29, look at it. Or verse 28, at the end of it. So that we may present everyone fully mature in Christ. See the outcome? He's doing it all because he's obsessed with the outcome. And verse 29, to that end, the outcome, he strenuously contends with all his energy that so powerfully works within me. He's a compatibilist. This makes a profound difference to actual outcomes in church life. Let me give you the example of the one I know well, which is church plants. Church plants, Geneva's just done an assessment of all our church plants across the country, and which has been a wonderful story if you've not picked it up. In the last 5-6 years, a couple of us have started this new church planting network amongst Reformed Evangelicals, and we've seen 65 churches planted in the last few years, and and another 10 or so are in the pipeline for the rest of this year. It's a fantastic movement. But we've done some research, and in Geneva church plants, 30% are unchurched. 30% are unchurched. That is a massive, many times over what you see in established churches. Why is that? Well, because they've come through Geneva. No, because the way our church planters think is outcome orientated. And let me tell you, even without them using that language, they do it. I'll tell you what happens. When you start a church with 30 people, and you turn up to church with 30 people that aren't giving enough money, you are obsessively outcome focused. Isn't that right? Because if you don't get extra people in this church, it's not going to last. And so any new person who comes, you are obsessively focused on doing the extra mile. You hear of a contact and you put on the whole detective thing where you work out how to get to that person and find the contact and find a way to actually stalk them and find where they live. And you do the whole detective thing to get them. You run down, chase down every single lead. And the congregation of 30 people are obsessively outcome focused too, because they're sitting in a church with only 30 people who are all trying to manage all the different things. And so every new person who comes in, they're all obsessed outcome people. When the church gets to viability, 100, 120, the minister might still be thinking, but he won't go the extra mile anymore. But the congregation stopped being outcome focused. Because someone comes, well, great if we get connected, that's lovely. But they don't chase it down anymore. They now switch to input thinking, being input focused. That is the big thing, I think, that occurs between a church plant and its over kind of sense of its success, so-called, in numbers of converts and so on. It's a big issue we have messing up our work. We are input obsessed to the exclusion of outcome responsibility. And it is a massive reorientation we need in our leaders. Let me show you one more thing and then I'll pause for questions. let me show you this. A vision statement for a mission person. Our purpose is to see our church active in mission, holding out the gospel to the world around us. Is that a good mission or a bad mission statement? Bad. Why? It's too vague, but it's an input-focused statement. Our purpose is to see people converted. I mean, you can add all kinds of other stuff, but do you see the difference? Now, if the guy running mission in your church thinks he's an input guy, then you've got a problem already. Whereas if you can get him and the church to start seeing our purpose is to see people converted, not just be faithfully holding out the gospel, then you've got a big change. I'll give you another one. A report to a congregation by a leader. 5 years ago we had nothing, now we have 5 staff, a budget of $600,000, an office that we work out of. He's excited. Why is he excited? Because for him that's big progress. We've now got a team. we've got facilities, we've got, but it's input. Who cares? I don't care about that stuff. What I care about is whether people are being saved and changed. When a leader becomes output focused, what they speak about, what oozes from them changes. The way they speak to people and what they actually call people to changes. Your prayers change. So much changes. And I think it's a huge piece we need to work on. Let me pause there. I'll stop. Yeah.
You're going to... Are we on? Thank you. Yeah, that's great. So let's try and have at least one or two questions. I guess I'll take the mic here and then I'll be able to call it to a halt. So put your hand up if you have a question and I'll come to you with the mic. Okay, Brad.
Thanks, Andrew. It sounds like you're talking about the kind of stuff like the life cycle of a church, and some of the other language out there is recasting a vision or a new direction for the church or things like that. Do you want to compare some of those things?
Yeah, no, vision... no, I'm not just talking about recasting a vision, although many of you might need to do that. I'm talking about the kind of vision you cast. What I'm talking about is making sure you're clear that the vision you're about is not just input faithfulness, but outcome make a difference. I think lots of churches who have swung into input thinking, which tends to be the maintenance cycle, need to have a renewed energy brought to it, a renewed vision and so on, and often new leadership, to get it back up again. And what I'm suggesting to you is part of the task that you have before you is to shift people to become output thinkers, to actually take responsibility for outcomes, to stop living in complacency and apathy. Just God's sovereign, he'll make it happen. That whole change needs to occur. And it's why is a church input? Why does a church of 30 output focused when it's 100 turn to input focus? Well, it's my problem. You see, one of the things if you've got that, if that's happened, I'd say, what are you going to do about it? No one else is going to come and fix it. What are you going to do? I pray, and God, I hope we get some people move into the area who are good. Take charge and take responsibility and do something. What are you going to do? Yeah.
Andrew, in the end, if the goal is presenting perfect disciples or on the last day with Christ, we can't measure that now. How do you, there are some proxies I assume that you use to say, yes, we've got people on that track or doing that. What are some of the ways you measure that? How can you tell whether the outputs are what you want compared to, say, a church of 5,000 people who are just coming up because they've got a great band that they like or something like that?
Yeah, good. I think most of us intuitively know what to measure. Most, you know, measures operate, you've got numeric measures and you've got anecdotal ones. So that's always the thing you've got to work. Not everything can be measured, and you typically can only measure 5 to 10% of what really is happening. So you've got all those caveats you've got to be aware of. But if I got you to sit down and list out everyone in your church, which you should be doing somehow, somewhere, you could make an assessment of where everyone's at, couldn't you? You could determine, are they unconverted, converted? Are they... converted but with kind of real problems that need to be fixed? Are they a solid Christian who's established well? Or are they someone who's going forward as a Christian and actually beginning to become a giver amongst us? You could make those assessments. And what I'd urge you to do is start doing that. You know, school teachers who only have to be concerned about the physical advancement of a child in education. We've got to be concerned about life, death, heaven and hell advancement of people. Far more important. But they are measuring their kids all the time to work out where they're at and how they're going, whether the teaching's working or not, whether the system of instruction's working or not. What do we do? Am I standing grumpy? What do? We just kind of drift along. As long as I keep preaching, whatever happens, happens. Oh, you've got souls in your hands. You've got to take some responsibility for what you're bringing to the work. And so you've got to measure it. Now, what measures? I mean, we do attendance, of course, giving, formal ministries versus informal ministries. These are all kind of very gross measures that we use to... We've got a dashboard. which is our kind of way to look at a snapshot of church and how it's going, where everybody's at. Now, we're running a larger church than many, so we're, you know, as the leader over it all, I've got to know what's happening in the health of this system of church life because I care about people's souls. And so I've got to have some way to know what's going on here. So we work very hard at measures. So I can tell you, you know, our church is very, very, it's very much larger than most churches. I can tell you where everybody's at. I know more about the problems and people struggling and the people going ahead than most churches of pastors of 100. Because I pay attention to reports. I get reports. All our growth group leaders give reports on what's happening. And that gets filtered all the way up and I know what's going on.